Iran fires ballistic and cruise missiles on the second day of its largest-scale military drills in the Persian Gulf.
All the weapons and equipment used in today's drills, including missiles, are made in Iran.
Russian President Vladimir Putin blames the West for escalating tensions in Europe, stressing that Moscow will respond to any Western aggression. European and British gas prices rise sharply to all-time highs on strong winter demand and simmering tensions with key supplier, Russia. This is World News. I'm Behrouz Sanjafi. Welcome. Top story this hour, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has held a second day of large-scale military drills in the southern parts of the country. Well, the IRGC's Navy forces successfully fired anti-ship cruise missiles, destroying mock enemy vessels. They also flew assault drones to destroy fixed and mobile targets. The five-day maneuvers, codenamed the Great Prophet 17, are underway in the Persian Gulf, the state of Hormuz, and the coasts of Hormuzgan, Bushehr, and Khuzestan provinces. The drills involve a variety of IRGC units. Iran regularly holds military drills to enhance the combat readiness of its armed forces. Iranian military experts and technicians have recently made great progress in developing and manufacturing a broad range of equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient. A commander of the IRGC's Navy, Rear Admiral Alireza Tangsiri, says that all the weapons used in the drills are made in Iran.
The drills, codenamed the Great Prophet 17, is being conducted in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz by the IRGC. One of the areas IRGC forces today are protecting is the Nasiat Islands. As you saw, we are fully prepared defense. Our forces on the island destroyed mock enemy targets trying to attack their positions, and no fixed or mobile targets were able to reach the island. This shows their operational power. All the weapons and equipment used in today's drills, including missiles, are made in Iran. Our capabilities are increasing every year. Compared to last year's drills, our forces were more prepared and their weapons have been upgraded.
Okay, now this is special coverage of that story. Let me invite a couple of guests to see what they think about this and get some insight. I'll be joined by Sameti Torabi, director of the Rosalat Strategic Studies Institute in the city of Qom, over the phone. Also, Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert, who's joining us out of Madison. Good to have you both, gentlemen. Let's go to the Iranian city of Qom. Sam, this is not the first time Iran is conducting military drills. This has been going on regularly, as you know. But maybe there is some special significance at this special juncture of time. Let's have your comments on that.
Sure. A particular time as it regards Iran, because, we have countries that are constantly threatening Iran, the U.S. and Israel being the two countries that constantly threaten Iran. So in that sense, Iran has to periodically show what it has in terms of its military capability to remind those countries of what the price would be if they did attack.
Now, Kevin, as you heard the IRGC Navy commander reminding that maybe there's some news to some of our audience that all of those military hardware used in the drills are made in Iran. And also, let's not forget the fact that all this achievement has been made in the presence of U.S. what it calls maximum pressure campaign and all those sanctions.
Well, actually, the maximum pressure campaign and the sanctions have backfired in a number of ways, and chiefly by forcing Iran to become self-sufficient, to learn how to do this stuff. And in fact, that's allowed Iran to pursue its course towards genuine sovereignty and independence far more effectively than it would have if it hadn't been sanctioned. It would have been stuck buying things from other countries, becoming dependent on the military hardware of other countries, as well as economic factors. And Iran could have gotten stuck, or at least half stuck, in the situation that so many countries around the world are stuck in, especially Islamic countries that are essentially dependencies on the Anglo-Zionist Empire, whereas Iran, because it was sanctioned, and the reason it was sanctioned was its dedication to becoming genuinely sovereign and independent, was forced to learn how to do these technologies itself, and it's done very well. And we've seen repeated indications that the forces of the empire are unwilling to attack Iran in a big way. They, the murder of General Soleimani nearly triggered the war that they didn't want, and they had to sit and allow Iranian missiles to rain down on an American base to get out of that war. The Atlantic magazine ran a simulation in 2003 showing that the U.S. loses if it fights Iran, and the Israelis know they're going to lose even worse unless they can somehow drag the Americans in, and even then they might lose. So Iran has done a terrific job at building up genuinely defensive forces, not threatening any neighbors, not threatening other countries, not going around the world trying to impose its system on everybody else the way the U.S. does. And I assume that these defenses will get stronger and stronger as time goes on.
Okay, thank you. Let me go back to Sidi Afkom on the phone. This maybe is a prelude to war. But the fact is that Iran has never started war, as far as I remember, in the past maybe a couple of centuries at least. So let's focus on this a little bit. And Iran is saying, and this is only to test its own combat readiness and in preparation for all the threats it's receiving. You know, every day, almost on a daily or weekly basis, Israel is openly threatening to strike Iran.
Yeah, like I said, the issue is not Iran. So it doesn't really matter what people think Iran is going to do or not do, because Iran has shown, as you pointed out, that who it is, what it does. The real issue is that whoever starts a war can start the war, but the issue is that Iran will end the war. This is the message. And there's nothing wrong with, you know, making your enemies understand what the reality is of if they would attack. As Kevin was pointing out, the Israelis do not have the ability to attack Iran on their own. This is called having deterrence, strategic deterrence. Mm-hmm. And Iran has that on a regional level as it relates to West Asia. No country in the region can attack Iran, because they know that if they would, if they attacked, it would also be completely destroyed. So that is why you see the Israelis always begging the Americans to come in. And of course, the Americans themselves are in no way, shape, or form capable of doing that. In terms of, you know, just looking at the weapons and the you know, amount of weapons that the Americans have, yes, the Americans have the ability to, you know, destroy the world eight times over, according to their own statistics. So that's nothing new. Mm-hmm. That's not the issue, that the Americans have a lot of weapons. The issue is, if they use these weapons, and this is the difference between having real analysis and understanding the reality of what's going on in the world, as opposed to just looking at certain numbers and trying to, you know, understand the world on a very surface level and without deeply trying to analyze it. The issue is, if the Americans use the weapons, what is the price that they have to pay? The price that they have to pay, and this is something that Iran is showing them, this is something that Russia is now showing them, we have to remember, this is in a larger global context. We have the Americans threatening the Chinese over Taiwan, we have the Americans threatening Russia over the Ukraine, and we have the Americans their vassals here in the region threatening Iran over, well, you know, take your pick, whatever they want to threaten Iran about this week.
Right.
So the issue is that just like the Chinese and just like the Russians, the Iranians are basically telling the Americans that even if they choose to use these large amounts of weapons that they have, that this will have a very heavy cost for them. To be more specific, basically what it will do is it will change the entire order that exists in West Asia. It will result in America being thrown out of the region in a very short amount of time, as opposed to what's happening currently without an American attack, which is that the Americans are gradually leaving, you know, country by country. Afghanistan yesterday, you know, tomorrow it might be Iraq and Syria. So this is something inevitable. There's only two outcomes in the future. One is the Americans leaving gradually, as they are now, without a war, and the other one is the Americans leaving with a war.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the issue, and it all goes back to the fact that the reality of international relations is based on what happens on the ground in terms of your hard power as it relates to your military and your technology. And this is what Iran focused on in the last, 40 years, and especially after the war, because Iran has basically been preparing to defend itself against a larger attack by the Americans after the war. This is the basis of the entire plan for the development of the Iranian military since after the Iran-Iraq war. So this is all goes back to that. And this has political results. This is the because of this, when the Iranian negotiators go to Vienna, they are able to insist on their demand. And when the other side starts threatening them, they can tell them, well, these are empty threats. You know that if there was an attack, what the result would be. And this is, so all of this has a political result. And the political result is that the Americans are going to have to choose whether they want to leave the region in a peaceful manner or whether they're going to leave it, the way they did Vietnam, the way they did Afghanistan.
Okay, thanks a lot for that. Sami Atitorabi, director of the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute in Qom. On the phone, and Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert in medicine, joined us in this special coverage. Now, moving on, Iran's Yemen ambassador, Hassan Irlou, has died due to complications from COVID-19, and Tehran says the envoy could not receive timely medical treatment because certain countries delayed his evacuation from Yemen. Here's a look at his profile.
Hassan Irlou was born in 1959 in Shahrare, a small town near Tehran. After the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, he joined the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was a veteran of the Iran-Iraq War and had been suffering from complications of chemical attacks. Irlou went on to become a senior diplomat. After Yemen's conflict broke out in 2015, he was transferred to Department for Yemen's Affairs at Iran's Foreign Ministry, where he served as deputy assistant to the minister. During that period, Irlou coordinated the transfer of Iranian humanitarian aid to Yemen in cooperation with the United Nations. In October 2020, he was appointed as Iran's ambassador to Yemen's National Salvation Government. In that portfolio, Irlou focused his efforts on unifying resistance groups and strived for national reconciliation. He encouraged Yemeni political groups to resolve their internal disputes through dialogue. The senior diplomat also worked towards garnering international support for mechanisms that would end the Yemen conflict and lift the blockade imposed by the Saudi military coalition. Irlou was diagnosed with COVID-19 days before he was transferred to Tehran from Sana'a to receive medical treatment. But by the time he arrived at a hospital in Iran's capital on Sunday, his condition had worsened irrevocably. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says that's because certain countries delayed his flight out of Sana'a. Khatibzadeh did not name any specific country, but Saudi Arabia and its allies in the war have been keeping Yemen under a blockade since 2015. The main airport in Sana'a has been closed for more than 5 years now. Hassan Irlou passed away on Tuesday morning due to complications from COVID-19. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has expressed its condolences to Tehran.
The Russian president blaming the West for escalating tensions in Europe, citing NATO's eastward expansion and the U.S. withdrawal from missile defense treaties. Vladimir Putin is saying that Washington's judgment has been clouded by euphoria after what it regarded as its victory in the Cold War. He also warned that Russia is prepared to take military technical measures in response to unfriendly Western actions over Ukraine. Western governments have recently been accusing Moscow of planning to invade Ukraine, citing Russia's military buildup near the border. Russia has denied the claim, in turn it demanded legal guarantees over its security from the U.S. and NATO. Early in the day, a senior Russian diplomat said that contacts have begun between Moscow and Washington on the security issue, and he said that there was a possibility that the two sides would reach an understanding. We're joined by author and researcher Greg Simons a short time ago, and he cast a doubt on the possibility of Russia reaching a meaningful agreement with the U.S. and NATO on the existing security concerns.
There's no point in looking at the issue that NATO and the U.S. are separate. The U.S. calls the shots in NATO, and They have been continually violating promises stemming from the promise to Gorbachev, which Matlock, the former ambassador to the USSR, has stated on many occasions. And if we look at it contemporarily, US promises and guarantees and even signed treaties and negotiations mean nothing. I mean, Iran knows this with the JCPOA, the different nuclear treaties which have been violated by the United States unilaterally. So these are worthless, and I doubt that they will actually make any agreement.
Well, let's take a look at Europe. The energy crisis there is just getting worse. Natural gas prices are skyrocketing to new all-time highs, and strong winter demand as much of the continent is bracing for sub-zero temperatures. The Dutch trading platform, TTF's natural gas price, soared by over 10% from Monday. Price in the UK also leapt to a fresh record peak. Price in both markets are seven times higher than the figures recorded at the beginning of the year. Analysts blame the spike on simmering tensions with key supplier Russia, which provides one-third of Europe's total gas supplies. They believe that ongoing controversy surrounding Russia's Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline also plays a role in the crisis. The project has faced a stiff opposition from the U.S. and some European countries. Europe's natural gas crisis comes amid soaring prices for electricity in a number of countries, including France. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's guidelines on the way of political activities of armed forces and said that he was strongly against involvement of the armed forces in political parties. Thus, he would warn the Iranian armed forces against supporting or opposing any specific political group or establishment. Today, we are going to present you other parts of the Imam's guidelines on the issue. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, insistently warned the armed forces against political rivalries due to the fact that it would cause disruption in the structure of the armed forces and would seriously undermine unity of these forces. He writes in his testament, "The very entering a party for the army, the IRGC, the military and police is not permitted. It will lead them to corruption. The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran believed that any involvement of the armed forces in parties or factions would eclipse national interest." He writes, "The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and other armed forces should not enter political affairs so that solidarity is fulfilled. If you enter, you would finally trouble yourselves and would finally stand against one another and would trouble the system and would weaken Islam. Imam Khomeini stressed that every component of the Islamic system should fulfill their own duties without interfering in the affairs of other parts. He writes in another part of his testament, "The duty of every military and garrison is to avoid meddling in the political affairs of the state, because if a soldier enters political affairs, he will lose his duty as a soldier. Thus, the enemies want to cause problems in the core of the army. One of the big problems is to bring political affairs in the army so that they start speaking political words. I order the army commanders that political issues should not be raised in the army." Imam Khomeini, as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran, emphatically told the parliament and the Supreme Defense Council that they are religiously obligated to prevent the involvement of the military in political affairs. He writes, "Since the revolution belongs to the whole nation and it is everyone's duty to safeguard it, the religious and national duty of the government, the nation, the Defense Council, and the Assembly of Islamic Council or Parliament is to oppose from the very first step. If the armed forces, whether the commanders or the higher and lower ranks, want to do anything against the interest of Islam and the country or enter in parties which would undoubtedly destroy them, and it is incumbent upon the leader and the leadership council to prevent this issue decisively so that the country is immune from damage." Imam Khomeini was so sensitive toward the involvement of armed forces in political affairs that some paragraphs were inserted in the law of punishment of the armed forces. In a part of the law, it has been made clear that the membership of the military personnel in any party or political organization and group will lead to 6 months to 3 years of imprisonment. Moreover, in the law for presidential election, it reads that the law enforcement forces should do their duties on ballot boxes to keep order, but they should seriously refrain from taking stances for or against any specific candidate. Furthermore, Articles 47 and 48 of the bylaw of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps stress that the IRGC is completely independent from any political party or group and should never find a partisan identity to act as a political party or organization. It stresses that the members of the IRGC have no right to be a member of any political party, group, or organization, and this continuation of membership will cause them to be expelled from the IRGC. Dear listeners, that marks the end of this episode. Next time, we will continue the discussion.
که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
About the following in the footsteps of Prophet of Islam and the Imams, Imam Khomeini says, the Islamic country should follow the Prophet of Islam and the Imams of Islam just as their conduct was one of the kindness toward the brothers, the people, the Muslims. We too, who are their followers, should behave kindly like them and strive to bring up our children in an Islamic way. If the youth are brought up in an Islamic manner, they will be honest and will not commit acts of betrayal. They will be useful for the country. I hope that God Almighty give you success, health, and assistance.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to Spring of Truth. I am your host, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, and we are looking at some point of views made by Al-Imam Al-Khumayni Ridwanullahi alayhi. Imam Khomeini said in one of his speeches, he said, all intellectuals plus westernized people and all the power wielders put together cannot produce the 15th of Khordad, June 5th, uprising. This is a very powerful statement by Imam Al-Khomeini. However, I'm not going to look at that whole phrase. I'm going to look at one word. He said intellectuals and westernized. I want to look at the word westernized. We have so much Muslims around the world. The West, they have realized that gun and a tank and a missile no longer wins a battle. It used to be maybe back in the day, but now it's useless. The more you actually fight people, the more you send bullets and missiles towards them, the stronger they become, the more determined they become. So they said that's a war that we can never win. So let's try another war. Let's try to mess with their minds. Let us try to change their beliefs. Let us change the way they see things.
Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu
So then the media came into play, and then we have this, what we call the soft war, where it is the war on the minds, the war on the intellectuals and the intellect of a person. And you see that the media had done such a good job in terms of evil that it had made so many people completely westernized. They thinking like the westerners, they act like the westerners, they move like the westerners, they eat like them, they dress like them. Even their haircuts are like them. That's how much westernized some of the Muslims have become, and some countries of the Muslims have become. And that is a very sad reality to see. This is something that we need to oppose. They come to us under the names of freedom and freedom of choice and a freedom of this and a freedom of that, and they want to deprive us of our Islamic beliefs, our Islamic culture. When in Iran, for example, we stand against these things because we don't want to be westernized. We want to have our faith. We want to have our beliefs. So as a Muslim, wherever you are, make sure, give attention to the fact that you should not become a westernized puppet without realizing it. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. every night and every day. Never forget to say La ilaha illallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
A simple question.
Who's really responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? The recent drowning of at least 27 migrants has led to renewed calls for a new approach to the ongoing crisis caused by those trying to start a new life in the United Kingdom. While British government officials claim it is on track to fix the broken asylum system, legislation has been criticised for making it harder for those arriving by boat to claim asylum in Britain. Those who speak for refugees even say the new proposals are actually cruel.
There's a pattern to the problem. A large proportion of these migrants come from Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. All countries torn apart by conflict supported or even started by Anglo-American military escapades. Furthermore, while the UN Refugee Agency says deaths can be avoided with coordinated action, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson and French President Emmanuel Macron have fallen out after the French President objected to Mr. Johnson's accusations that France has not done enough to stop migrants crossing the channel. The impact of these political and military conflicts has turned out to be lethal. War and conflict disrupt countries and entire regions, forcing migrants to flee. In their desperate efforts to start a new life, some pay traffickers large sums to assist them in their efforts to cross the channel to England. This leads to illegal immigration, increasing tensions between France and the United Kingdom, and deaths in the sea, while France and Britain blame each other for the migration issue and the human toll of those who drown.
To what extent is the UK responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? And who should be creating a new place for people to live after escaping from war-torn conflicts in which the United Kingdom plays a part? Simple questions with important answers. And we begin our inquiry with a straightforward and direct question. What does the public think of the deaths of 27 migrants who drowned while trying to cross the Channel? We put that to the public here in London. This is what they told us.
A boat which is about the size as that one that goes up and down the river here, the small one. 27 people were on it, and it capsized, and they drowned this was last week. Yeah, and they just drowned, and their bodies were washed up on the shore. Yeah.
It's so sad to hear that. Yeah, I mean, things like that should not be happening in the future, of course.
It's an absolute tragedy, and I just wish that there were actually legal safe routes for people to get to Britain in order to claim refugee status.
The way that we talk about, you know, helping people and things like foreign aid, but when there's real issues like people trying to escape persecution, I think it's shameful that the government, you know, practically ignores or tries to deflect the problem.
I mean, it's just a shame, really, isn't it? I mean, it's upsetting when anyone dies, let alone migrants. I mean, there's the whole... I'm sure like an overwhelming majority are just trying to escape what can be just explained nothing short of an absolute travesty.
sad and disappointed.
I don't think that's very nice to hear at all.
They have family, they have mother, father, sons, daughter, and I think we or the government need to pay the attention in that case.
I think it's a terrible tragedy. I don't think anyone deserves to die when trying to gain freedom and have the rights that we should all be given as human beings upon this earth.
Well, obviously, wasted life is always a tragedy. But it would not happen if people didn't get on broken lilos and try to cross the busiest waterway in the world in treacherous weather.
Horrific. And why don't we have a secure way whereby these people fleeing from Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria are able to come to this country? I think we've opened the doors to, is it 3 million from Hong Kong? Why can't we find a humane, civilized way of helping these people?
It's very sad. It's sad that they have to move, like, come over here and try and find, like, obviously living over here. Like, it's sad that they have to do that, like, rather risk their life than just trying to find a better life where they actually are. I don't know, it's quite sad.
French government is responsible first because that's their border. And then the British government should take care of their English waters or English Channel to control the border. I think nobody should risk their life for better life.
It's terrible. It shouldn't have never happened in the first place. I mean, they should just have safe passage to prevent this to start with.
First, I suppose, used the word tragic, and it is a tragedy. Obviously, I think everybody can be completely sympathetic to the situation. And, of course, I think everybody was greatly saddened by the situation, considering there were children involved as well, which makes it even worse.
Many are refugees from conflicts fought by Britain, including in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other Middle Eastern countries. In the public's view, what responsibility does the UK have for these deaths?
I think we have a responsibility to provide safe passage for people to come here to attempt to claim refugee status. If we feel that we have the right to go and intervene in different ways around the world, then we have the responsibility to kind of follow up the results of that, I think.
Oh, we have massive responsibility. You know, it's anything that, you know, is initiated or guns that we sell to different parties in these conflicts is entirely, you know, the British government's responsibility to do something about it.
There's a very, very valid argument to make that to a certain extent, intervention in certain countries has worsened political situations. I mean, the arguable thing, you know, you can look at situations like maybe Syria or Iraq. Afghanistan is a very good one, I think.
I think we're responsible if we're involved in the conflict, but we're also responsible as a better-off country to help people who are not safe.
It's hard to pinpoint the exact responsibility if the conflict that they're running from is caused by the UK or at least contributed to by the UK. There's definitely some responsibility there, in my opinion anyway.
Well, this should be something that maybe the governments of the world should look at, and those of us who have more to give should be able to give and allow safe haven for these people.
I think we do have some responsibility for taking our fair share of refugees from conflicts that we've had a part in.
They're mainly refugees from countries which have internal problems, and that's why there was an influence from the British. And there are a number of countries that they could have stopped in along the way if they truly wanted somewhere that was just safer than where they came from.
These crossings are a consequence of us so-called global Britain meddling around in the Middle East, so we have a lot of responsibility.
I don't really know who to blame, but I'm pretty sure both sides should be responsible, like both France and the Britain part, because is there a kind of shared channel, I guess, so.
There's some implicit responsibility because, you know, we've armed these countries, we've been involved militarily, and we haven't supported some of the kind of the transportation of the immigrants in the first place that were suffering in these countries.
That's a very loaded question. I think, obviously, they've travelled many miles to get to the UK. Clearly, I think there's a lot of discussion about being housed in the first port of call of whichever country they go to. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't know. I'm not an expert in that situation, but I guess if they do get to the UK, they're entitled to a hearing. They're entitled to civil liberties, and obviously they're entitled to actually put their case forward. And that's the problem. I don't think they do get that. And perhaps the UK needs to have a rethink on that point.
Yes, some days ago also I heard about the problem in Afghanistan. I think that's something that is impossible to think in the 21st century.
French police have been seen to watch on as many refugees board boats to cross the channel. What do people here in Britain think of the French allowing migrants to make these hazardous crossings?
The French police have watched on. They've been filmed watching on while the traffickers send the boats across. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's difficult because if they... I don't know, that's a tough one, because if they stop them, then they stop them being able to try and find somewhere safer. But at the same time, it's not a safe journey either. But it's I don't know, that's a tough one.
From a legal perspective, it very well could be justified. From my opinion, that doesn't come across as right.
Yeah, I wish that there was closer and better tempered and more even collaboration between Britain and France and between Britain and the rest of the EU over this, to be fair. It's obviously not ideal that people are being allowed to launch themselves into small, unsafe boats into the channel. We've seen the result of that this year, so I wish that that wasn't happening.
If we start the war, obviously we should be taking responsibility for it. So, I mean, yeah.
The entire international community needs to take some responsibility and work together, like I say, to try and find a solution.
If you're seeing somebody getting on a boat that you know is probably not going to make it, I mean, in my opinion, I would be saying, don't make that crossing.
I think it's a responsibility of the French government.
Didn't see them to know if that's true or not. If it is, then they should be held accountable, but I haven't seen any evidence either way on that.
A very complex issue, I think. It's wrong of them to not intervene, although there's always circumstances around everything. But I think there's always a duty of care to people, no matter who or where they come from.
I can't understand how we haven't taken back control from the French police.
I think that's part of the reason why they want to come over here, because they're just not getting looked after very well, clearly, either. If they're getting allowed to get on the boats, causing tragedies, and they're allowing it to happen. We're trying to stop it, and they're allowing it to happen and allowing them to come while we're trying to stop.
I think British government, to be honest, because if you get involved in someone else's business, then there is always the consequences, so you have to face the consequences.
Basically, it's wherever they seek in, whichever country they look at to find asylum, that's where they should be housed in the first place.
I think what I probably would like to say, you wouldn't want to repeat, but I think that's absolutely disgusting. Clearly, if it's on the shores of the UK, we would expect the police to do their duty, and I think the same thing should apply to the French police.
The statistics underline the size of the issue and how little Britain is really doing to fix it. The Home Office plans to accept 5,000 people in the first year of the Afghan Citizens Resettlement Scheme, and up to 20,000 more afterwards. However, by late November 2021 alone, it is estimated that during this year, over 26,000 people, many from Afghanistan, had already arrived in small boats after crossing the channel illegally. Yet the Afghan conflict, in which the UK played a central role, generated 2.5 million refugees, of whom 2.2 million live in Iran and Pakistan, showing how small the UK's contribution is to fixing the problem it helped cause.
Who should be held responsible for finding new homes for refugees escaping conflicts fought by Britain?
I think a lot of responsibility therefore comes onto the government to make sure that we can give safe passage to these refugees and we can allow them in and look after them, as the conflict is our fault.
I believe they should have handled the issue like in a more precise manner.
Just because that's the country they went in first doesn't mean that country has equal responsibility for them being a refugee in the first place.
We're partly responsible, and countries should work together. Unfortunately, we seem to be global Britain going it alone, but we should work, like with the health crisis on COVID, countries should work together to solve these problems, be it climate change, refugees. It's a shame that we don't have anyone with any diplomatic skills from Lord Frost, Rab, Priti Patel, Boris, to make sure we are responsible global citizens.
It should be a shared effort between more governments. I'd say Britain, France, and whoever participated in that in those wars. That would seem fair to me.
Allowing them to make the crossing, letting people make something that's unsafe where they could possibly lose their lives is almost like a criminal act. They're complicit in the deaths in a way by letting that happen. Yeah.
Well, again, I think it's down to probably every country to do their part. And we hear all the figures on the media. You never know whether you're hearing the right figures or not. Fairly obviously, I think other countries in Europe probably have taken more than the UK, and possibly the UK need to rethink their policy in that respect.
Who's actually responsible for rehousing people who've been victims of conflict that Britain itself has led or been involved?
I think if people have refugee status in Britain, then Britain is responsible for rehousing them. We shouldn't forget that Britain has, I think, around about 1% of the world's refugees here. We have a tiny, tiny percentage of the world's refugees. And if we want to see ourselves as global Britain, as a country that has a role on the global stage, then we need to step up and take responsibility for some of this.
I would not like to comment on that, yeah, but these things should not be happen. I mean, if they are watching it, they should have stopped it, of course.
I don't want to just pile blame onto my own government. It's obviously the responsibility of all governments to try and find a solution for these people.
But it is our responsibility as humans and as common man to account for one another. So not just the government, but we all, as a collective, need to step up and do something about it.
My opinion is, rather than trying to figure out exactly who is responsible, is that if you feel you can do something, and as a country, if we feel we can do something, then we just should.
What is the public's advice to the British government about refugees who risk death in the process of trying to cross the channel?
I think these practices should be stopped. I mean, force measures should be taken to stop it, because if the people are trying to cross the channel, they can lose their lives. So, yeah, of course.
My advice to government would be to work with people, with our friends and colleagues in the EU, to step up and to act more humanely, to give people safe passage routes.
If the government wants to, you know, be re-elected, they need to take action and do something about it.
There are plenty of people in the country who would want to help. It's just reaching out and maybe putting together a system where people who can help and can provide housing, or even if it's just temporary. You know, there's a lot of people with spare bedrooms.
Everybody knows it's an issue, and it's been an issue for quite some time. My advice would be stop ignoring it. Do something.
Let's try and find a way where they don't have to risk death, and we can help them if it is that we're responsible.
Oh, I think, the Britain can help people who are homeless to find homes and so on.
I would say it's a very complex situation, but human life has to be saved amongst anything else. But I think rather than spending so much time trying to dissuade people from crossing, they should look at the reason why the people are going in the first place.
Work with other countries in a diplomatic manner to find a solution.
Should be able to give them set boats and, you know, better like accommodation to come over on, rather than just a dinghy that's probably going to sink halfway across. Like, we've got the boats, we've got like all the lifeguards and everything. We could be helping save more than anything, do you know what I mean? We have lifeguards that swim the channels on a night time to make sure everything's all good. So we could be making things a lot safer, and communication with the other governments as well is even better. Like,
it doesn't matter what they're like, what country they came from, but their life matters, so they should be taken care of. They should have been taken care of.
Not all the immigrants are genuine immigrants. Most of them, they are economic immigrants. So finding ways to support them in their own country so they don't have to cross the borders, first place. If they have come over risking their life, then find the ways to settle them.
Create a safe passage. That's all we need, is a safe passage. They shouldn't be risking their lives in the first place. Otherwise, they are complicit in what's happening.
Again, I think we need to put something into place, a more meaningful policy in place to give these people a chance to have their story heard, to have their situation checked.
The 27 migrants who drowned in the English Channel as they tried unsuccessfully to reach British shores made the headlines. These fatalities also provoked a bitter war of words between British and French politicians after UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson attacked French authorities and, by implication, the French president himself, Emmanuel Macron, for failing to prevent the crossings.
Many make these dangerous journeys because of the impact of British conflicts on their homelands. A number of observers now believe that Britain must accept responsibility for causing much of the migrant problem. It seems a tragic irony that after travelling thousands of perilous kilometres from their war-torn homelands, desperate migrants seeking a new life drown within sight of the very country that turned them into refugees.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and IranSat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.